Accession number 146, reel 4.
Major O'Brien, reel 4.
As I was saying, it was amazing the little things when one was a prisoner, sort of what was a morale booster. And I shall always remember a particular chap. He was called Tommy Sampson, and he clearly was a musician. He'd been captured in Tobruk, and he had his trumpet with him. And Tommy Sampson used to play us all the sort of tunes of the day, the jazz tunes of the day. And I remember he started this at Bari, and then he continued later on too. In fact, he formed a jazz band. But anyway, it was just this a chap sort of playing new tunes, just blowing a trumpet and making you feel, oh well, it's not the end of the world, you're a prisoner, but music, you know, the food of love and all that. And but his was all jazz stuff, and Tuxedo Junction, and all the ones that were popular at the time of that era. And it was a great morale booster. Anyhow, we then got to Kieti, which was a permanent camp. Kieti is it's quite a big town, really, though we were just sort of down the hill from the main town in this camp. We arrived there, let me see, it must have been now, to getting towards the end of July, I suppose, roughly early August. And this consisted of five bungalows, including a large building at the top, sort of a large low bungalow building, which was the bathhouse, the main cookhouse, and a large area which became our theatre, which produced some very good entertainment for us in due course. Kieti really was not a very, very difficult camp. We were lucky. We were up sort of around about central Italy, just below central Italy, in the Abruzzi area. And the climate was good. Early, in the early days, of course, before we got our battle dress and the Red Cross, our first winter wasn't all that funny, because we didn't get our Red Cross battle dress till almost the turn of the year. That's right. So we'd had a bit of cold weather, and we still only had our desert kit on. And our rations weren't entirely... We got what the soldiery got, apparently. And once Red Cross parcels, British Red Cross parcels, started coming through, our general morale and health improved. Though, I say, in the early part of the winter of 42, there was quite an outbreak of jaundice in the camp, where one went yellow, you know, and sort of it was a liver complaint. It wasn't a deadly complaint, but a lot of chaps did catch jaundice. Fortunately, I was lucky I didn't. But there again, we feel it was to do with General A not being quite clad correctly, and B sort of the diet not, you know, having certain deficiencies, I suppose. But taking it all in all, once the Red Cross parcels started to come through reasonably regularly, we used to get a Red Cross parcel a week under normal circumstances, and the British Red Cross parcels consisted of margarine, chocolate, rolled oats, a tin of condensed milk, some chocolate, and sometimes a few cigarettes. But most of the cigarettes were sent privately from home, those who smoked. I smoked in those days, but not a lot, so it wasn't a great factor in my life. The other form of parcel was what they called the Canadian one, and that was a much more great prize, because they used to have butter in theirs, butter and margarine, butter and jam, and great biscuits, wonderful biscuits, which were very, very sort of lovely to eat. Coffee, real coffee. Well, I think I should skip any further detail, and I'll go on now to the evening of the 8th of September 1943, when we heard over our camp. We had loudspeakers round the camp, which used to give us the Italian news all the time, particularly when they thought they were winning and so on, but we always got it. And eventually, anyway, it was the evening of the 8th of September, and suddenly it came over the camp loudspeakers that Marshal Badoglio had asked for an armistice. That was the 8th of September. And we had realized that possibly from about the July, because I think it was in July that Mussolini actually was deposed. And we realized that sort of, I think it was towards the end of July, something like that, when the Grand Council had met and sort of thrown him out. And we didn't know this at the time, obviously, but we knew something was odd was going on. And then this 8th of September announcement sort of confirmed it. Well, there you were. You had about 900 officers in this camp. And the Italian guards, we had quite an amusing, I mean, you can imagine it. We got this news about 8:30 in the evening, and whereas we used to have to be in our bungalows and sort of out, you know, not allowed to sort of roam about the camp, once this announcement being made, we were allowed to sort of not roam about all over the camp, but to sort of all congregate outside our bungalows, as it were, without let or hindrance. Because it was extraordinary, the little Italian guards were escaping. We had this camp was surrounded by a high wall, what, about 12 feet high, I suppose. And these little men they got ladders from somewhere, I suppose, from the maintenance men's ladders. And these little soldiers, you know, they were just putting the ladder up against the wall and their suitcases, and they're up the ladder and they were off, you see. And we were watching all this going on. And it was quite funny because the people, we also had carabinieri in the camp. Now, the carabinieri are a sort of a form of policemen who are much more sort of disciplined and so on. But the carabinieri weren't really in great strength. And they were just all these infantry soldiers looking after the boxes around the camp, you see. And all these boys reckoned, well, the war's over, we're going home, sort of thing. And we had a wonderful, that night, it was wonderful, hardly anybody slept, you see, and sort of watching all these little boys running off. And there were two carabinieri sort of circling the camp on the inside, very steadily walking around. And of course, as soon as they passed a certain sector, where the guards, where these two men were going up, would go the ladder, and be a couple more go up, you see. It was quite amusing. Anyway, that meant when they arrived the next day, and we had no guards. So the senior British officer of the camp then was a Colonel Marshall. He'd Indian Army. He'd commanded the force Marathas in the Indian Army, and he became prisoner of war. He was our senior British officer. Well, I don't know really what got into him. It seems that the commandant then was a Colonel Massey. And this Colonel Massey, we learned afterwards, was a dynamo fascist, you see. And he was not at all pleased with Mussolini having gone and Badoglio asking for armistice. Clearly, he was anti. So the story we were told and came to conclusion that Colonel Marshall was being fed all sorts of duff information by this Colonel Massey and saying, look, we have information, the British are landing everywhere, sort of thing. It was rather stupid because, well, we only had their radio, and we didn't have radios of our own. We only had their information to go on, and we weren't quite sure what was happening and what the situation would be. So anyway, cut a long story short, Marshall, he broadcast, he said, all British officers, yes, we had some Americans in the camp at that time. In fact, the Americans had taught us this famous, their real form of baseball, and we had some very interesting matches with them. Because, again, a small digression, we had both Bill Bowles, the famous Yorkshire cricketer, and Freddie Brown of England, Captain England. They were both in the camp, and they became quite stars at this baseball game. And in the end, we used to sort of have the America, you know, America v. the rest, and that's some great fun. Anyhow, Colonel Marshall said, no, the Americans, a lot of them said, well, we're not taking notice of your British officer, we're going. And a lot of them just walked out of the camp and literally bought tickets at the Kiev station and went down by train for a long, long way, went south. We sat there like good boys, because he said any British officer, and of course we had all our ranks and war out records and so on. Any British officer who disobeys my orders, he'll be court-martialed out of the war, because I'm telling you, you will stay put, because I'm responsible for your safety. And of course, we've had to buy it, I suppose. We needn't have done, but it wouldn't have made any difference if we hadn't, but we did, most of us did. And it so happened that there were about, three tunnels going in the camp were almost completed. The particular one that I was involved in, it went, it was a very good tunnel insofar as it wasn't a long tunnel, because we'd been able to construct it from this building at the top of the camp, which, and in the bathhouse, there was a bathhouse there, and it went down to a well, and you had a great boiler for our baths and so on, and there are two steps there, so my second in command of my company and myself, we were put on looking after the boilers, our engineer experience. I mean, we got a job, we all got to start a bit of a job in the camp, you see. Ours was to stoke up the boilers for baths, you see. So we looked around, this is about 3 months or 4 months before the armistice. We thought, well now, we're pretty near the wall here. I wonder if there's any, there's two steps there. I wonder if we will explore. We took the top step off very carefully and we had lookouts. But we had a certain amount of latitude because the Italians, they weren't all that sort of keen of searching you every other day and so on. They were pretty keen, but they seemed to be reasonably laid back about the bathhouse and the cookhouse area. Anyway, we took the second step out, dug down, and then found that we were only about 30, 40 yards from the main wall. And by the time the 8th of September, we'd actually excavated under the main wall, and we had actually an escape hatch ready to break out. Well, after Colonel Marshall's instruction, of course, everything's put on hold, as it were, and we, 13 days later, 13 days, on the 21st, on the 8th of the armistice, 21st of September, suddenly, at 10 o'clock at night, around about that time anyway, suddenly, a batch of Germans arrived, were up on the walls in the sentry boxes, and we were in the bag again. The Germans had arrived. Now, clearly, Massey had known about this, or he colluded, or whatever. And I mean, he was just. And of course, what could Colonel Marshall do? Nothing. What could any of us do? It was just we were in the bag again. So 3 days later, the Germans decided they'd move the whole camp. You see, what had happened, when the Italians collapsed, the Italians had been the Germans usually did the capturing, and the Italians were the jailers. And they had, when all these camps, all these guards disappeared, and all this, they suddenly found an awful lot of, and they had manpower to find these guards for these camps, you see. So they were all very keen to sort of clear the camps, send them to Germany, and then concentrate on what troops ahead, because by that time we'd landed, I think, on the mainland Italy on the 3rd of September, the Allies, and they realised they're going to have had a hell of a lot of territory to look after, and prisoners was just a damn nuisance. So anyway, on the 24th they moved us to this place called Sulmona, which had also been, Sulmona had been a very large POW camp for both officers and other ranks. It was about, what was Sulmona, 20-odd miles down the south. anyhow, as part of this move, when the balloon really went up and we were back in the bag again, we decided that everybody wanted to, our tunnel was top of the pot, because it was on the right side to get out, even if the Germans were there, you know. It was, we were on their blind side of most of their sentry boxes. And it became somewhat popular, and of course everybody wanted to get in it to go, you see. And so long story short, we had to sort of more or less say, well, all right, who really wants to go, da-da-da-da. But it got so sort of crowded and so on, it was hardly worth, staying there. So anyway, there was a chap called McLucas. He was a captain in the Cameron Highlanders, and he'd been responsible for all the soil disposal of our tunnels. He was a soil disposal officer. Because we're digging these tunnels, we had to put the spoil somewhere. And the Italians had actually let us cultivate gardens and things, so a lot of it went there. And a lot of it used to go all around the camp. Chaps used to come and sort of let it out of the bottom of their trousers. I mean, it was tedious, but amusing. Kept us occupied. Anyway, McLucas said to me, he said, I don't know about all this tunnel business. He said, what about taking off our badges of rank? He said, and getting in with our... We had a whole bungalow full of batmen. About 50, 60-odd chaps who are our batmen, you see. And he said, when we go to... We were told we would go to Sulmona. He said, now, when we get to Sulmona, he said, if we go in with the soldiery, he said, we'll stand a much better chance of getting out there, you see, because we won't be so closely guarded. Anyway, that's what we did. And we went to Sulmona. We went at other ranks and sort of... And the Germans, you see, they were... relatively slack, because they were so embarrassed with all these prisoners, and the fact that they counted them all their supply. I mean, they didn't worry about sort of that this was Lieutenant O'Brien and that was Captain McLucas and all the rest of it, and we were just bonds to them. And so we got away with that, and we got to Sulmona, and we went in a room, one of these rooms. I suppose they sort of had pitched roofs and tiles on the roofs. And I suppose we were in there with about 20 other ranks, I suppose, might have been a few more, on these bunk beds. And McLucas and myself decided that we'd have a look up in the roof. Now, we had odd little bits of saws and things that, you know, sort of, that had been made to cut up timber and that sort of thing. And we were able... believe it or not, to knock up a ladder, very rough ladder, got some timber. There was stuff all over the place, because this place had been a POW camp, you see, but after the armistice, there had been a mass breakout from there, with other ranks, and there was all sorts of stuff all over the place. A lot of the chaps had been recaptured, but not a lot of them, not all that vast amount. They had really been sensible. They had sort of got out of it, and that was their salvation in a way, because, as I say, we sat like silly things for 30 days, you see. But they anyway, the camp was not entirely full when we got back. There was all our officers were moved there, you see, all the ones that were in Katie, and our other ranks and so on, and any stragglers that had been picked up from the original camps, they were there. Anyhow. We were very wise to do what we did, because we weren't guarded very, very, very sort of severely. We were just left to our own devices, except for one roll call. So we were able to sort of get up, and we took the tile off the roof. We were able to get in, and it had these joists up there, and they had about 3 foot from the... the pitch of the roof. Must have been just 3 foot, 3 foot six. You couldn't stand up in there, but you could crawl around in there, you see. And we decided that we could hide up there by taking up bedboards and food, water, and even a sanitary bucket, because this was a long room, and we were able to produce this thing and put it right at the end, and we'd even got hold of some creosote and all sorts of things. Because, I say this, it was quite extraordinary, the stuff that was lying about in this camp, which we got hold of. Anyway, we said to the chaps below, I mean, while all this was going on, I mean, we told them, and they were all jolly good. I mean, nobody sort of was stupid and went talking about it. And we said, right, now what we do, we reckon that we can take two chaps from the room, and us two, there'll be four of us. We reckon that's about the maximum we're going to be able to live in any sort of, not exact comfort, but practically in this hidey hole. So, on the 28th of September, 28th of September, we decided that we'd have a trial run. Or was it the 29th? 28th or 29th of September, we'd have a trial run. So we asked these chaps to, you know, sort it out who'd be the two to come up. And one of them was a He was a corporal in the Norfolks, and he'd been the assistant cook at Kieti. And one of the weapons he'd brought for them was a great cook's knife, one of these great, you know, things like that, cut the meat up and so on. And he'd brought that with him. I don't know. He wasn't searched, you see, because the Germans were very laissez-faire about the whole thing about when they were moving us and searching us. They were just glad to sort of get rid of us, I suppose. And he brought this cook's knife, which came in very useful later, which I shall tell you. Anyway, we got up into this thing on the afternoon of the 29th, I think it was, yes, 29th. And we'd went all our stuff up there. We took our palliasses up there and our boards, and we were able to sort of sleep. But of course, you had to be careful not to sort of stand off the joists, otherwise you'd go through the ceiling. Anyway, we got comfortable up there, and we thought, we'll see how this works. And we had we'd arranged for the chaps down below. Well, you know, I mean, they'd finally sealed us in. It was all part of the arrangement. And we were in there. So early in the morning of the 30th of September, we had a little knock at the ceiling. We're all being evacuated today. We've been told we're off. So we said, oh, well, this is us. We stay here. And we were there. We were then in that roof. There was a certain amount of light came through some of the tiles, and the air wasn't all that bad. And we had our Red Cross parcels with us, unexpired portions of. We had water, and we had our sanitary bucket, which was way, way at the end. And of course, we didn't have to use that all that much. And we were sort of there, for better or worse. Well, they did evacuate the camp, and this was then the 1st of October, 2nd of October, and we'd heard all sorts of rumours that the Germans, they were going to come and machine gun the roofs and blow the places up, and we'd sort of, I think those are rumours put about. You get all sorts of rumours in a prison camp, and I think a lot of it was put about by the Germans, you know, to make sure the people didn't hide in our places. Anyway, we were in the roof for better or worse, and I remember about the third day in there, in the early morning, we heard a lot of explosions going on. And we thought, my God, they are there. They're going to blow this camp up, and us with it, you see. But in effect, all they were doing was blowing one of the big walls down at the end of the camp. It was a large camp to get some tanks in as a, you know, temporary lager for them or something. And life in this hidey hole, it wasn't all that bad. I remember I read the Life of Nelson up there. That's the book I had with me, and one just lay about and so on. And then finally, we got very short of water, and also during this time, you see, we weren't quite sure, particularly after Hindley's explosions, whether the Germans had all gone. We had wrecked a place at the wire where we'd go through, which was between two sentry boxes, which weren't manned, as it happened, because the Germans didn't have the manpower to do it, and particularly as they'd moved the whole camp. Anyway, we got very short of water, and but we did have the odd little sort of snigger to ourselves, because during the day sometimes you get German troops coming through, walking through these rooms. Obviously off-duty boys, young fellows, you could hear them joking, they'd throw pillows up at the thing, just the sort of thing troops do in here, where we were up there like little mice, not a word. And that was the sort of thing that went on. So finally, it was the day of the 6th, and we were really short of water. We'd actually put out a flat 50 cigarette tin on a stick, and it had got a little rain that day, and we got a little water in that way, but we realised that, look, we'll have to get out tonight. And this was the night of the 6th, 7th of October, and that is where the cook's knife came in, because about 10 o'clock, we said to old Ginger, all right, Ginger, cut your grates in the lath plaster, and then we let ourselves down into the room, you see, on our blankets. The extraordinary thing was, when we tried to stand, we couldn't, because we hadn't stood for a good 7 days, we hadn't used our legs. And it was quite funny, because we were so thirsty, and at the end of this hut was a wash house where we knew there was plenty of water. Anyway, we crawled about and got our sea legs, and we had the parcel we had was a Canadian, they had this Klim milk, and I remember we mixed up a lot of this Klim milk and drank it and sort of had a really slaked our thirst and got our our sea legs, as it were. And then we thought, right, now we make for the wire. And it meant crawling across a compound, what, probably about 30, 40 yards to the wire, roughly, it wasn't any more. And then there were about five lowish fences, but gannet wire, you know, pretty heavily wired, but also barbed wire. And gannet wire was, that wasn't so much gannet wire. There was the odd bit of gannet wire here and there, which is the coil wire, which is even a bigger obstacle. Anyway, McLucas, a very thorough chap was McLucas. He'd taken up string and so on to tie up the bits of things so we could crawl under. And anyway, cut a long story short, by about 1:30, 1:45, we had actually got through four of these fences. We'd crawled under and we just stood up outside. Fortunately, the sentry boxes were not manned. We thought they wouldn't be, so we were lucky there. And then we just headed straight up into the woods. And we kept walking and walking and walking. And this camp somewhere was in a valley. And we went up into the high ground, I don't know how many miles we were, but there when our first stop was at first light or just after. And we had our first rest. And we were able to look down, and there was the camp in the valley. So we knew we were well and truly away. And then we journeyed south. Our idea was to go and meet our own forces on the River Sangro or somewhere like that. And but as we got closer, we started meeting a lot of people, oddbods who said, you know, you're getting pretty close now. And there were sort of odds. People said, well, I was an ex-Italian officer and I am this and that and the other. We met some of them. Some of the people were quite good. You could tell they were, you know, they knew a thing or two. And so I said to McLucas, I said, well, look, don't you think it'd be a good idea if we just rested a day or two and really found out if it is going to be all that, in the area when it is all that dangerous, instead of rushing headlong and probably getting recaptured. So anyway, McLucas decided to part company. I was more cautious, I suppose. And he and the corporal went on. Incidentally, we had another chap, and he was a sapper, as it happened, but on our way between Sulmona and this place where we decided to part company, we stopped at various little villages and in the country, you know, way away from any main roads, and the Italians, they were very kind. They fed us, the peasantry, you know, and so on. We slept in their barns and that sort of thing. The usual thing that went on. Anyway, we'd lost one of the chaps. He decided that he'd spotted a rather a comely wench in one of the villages, and he stayed there. So we lost him. I don't know what happened to him, or even what he did, ever got back to him. I don't know. But anyway, he decided to peel off, and of course he was free to do as he wished. So so there was just McLucas, the corporal, and myself. And we decided to part company. And that, they pressed on, and in effect, McLucas wrote to me after the war. And they had a very, very near shave, but they made it. And I say good luck to them, because they were out of the bag and I was still really behind the lines. Anyway, I then met up with this chap called Peter Self and two other sappers. He had two sappers. I know gunners and sappers seem to get together a lot. Anyway, he had these two other chaps with him, these sappers. And they were in this particular area. Now, we were getting quite close to the River Sangro, and they said to me, well, now, look, we have found the most perfect camouflaged little hidey hole. It's a grotto, and it was used, it was an old shepherd's place with the shepherds, because we were then sort of in mountainous country, but very wooded and so on, and it clearly was an old shepherd's place, but was vacated, you see, and round about there were farmhouses.